So today I'm sitting here with Lewis Crompton, and Lewis Crompton, he has been working for Robert Kiyosaki. He has been teaching, trading, and investing for almost a decade now. He has created StarTrading.com, and I had a chat with my friend Daniel Wood, who recently joined my podcast, and Daniel told me that Lewis Crompton is an upcoming absolute superstar in the world. And during our first conversation, I really enjoyed Lewis being so honest, being so authentic. And today I will explore how did he build StarTrading.com. We will talk about investments, we will talk about his childhood, we will talk about what made Lewis Crompton become the person he is today. Welcome to my podcast, Lewis. How are you today?
I am very well, thank you. And I'm very excited to be here. So, yes, I'm very much looking forward to it as well.
First, I must ask one question. I mean, how is it even possible to like Chinese food more than Indian food?
It may not be possible for a lot of people, but for me, it definitely is. Although I will be having an Indian tonight. We've already discussed, me and my partner have discussed what we're eating tonight, and it is an Indian. But that is, to be honest, although New Year goals and health and everything like that, we don't have a kitchen that we can cook in at the moment because we've just moved house. So it's a good excuse to go and eat food. And tonight will be Indian food. So yeah.
Cool. I love Indian food. Have you been to India?
I have, yes, but only to Mumbai. Only to
Went to
Mumbai.
Mumbai. Yeah. Now I fell in love with the food and the culture. So every time I get the chance, we have Indian food here. But Chinese is good too.
Chinese is my secret, well, not that secret addiction, definitely. We all need
What's
one. We all need one.
The story there, Lewis? Have you always like loved Chinese food, or is there a story there?
I've actually never been to mainland China, so I can't say that there's like a cool travel story associated with it, but I have always loved Chinese food. I think I'm undiagnosed ADHD, I'm convinced of that, and one of the symptoms is you become obsessed with certain foods at certain times, which is why I have like a rotating sweet tooth as well. So I'm not really massively into sugary stuff, but sometimes I'll get a real craving for a really long time of one particular very strange sweet food. But Chinese has never left me. It's always been the constant faithful addiction that I've had. And I remember even when I was early days, like in my early teens, and getting a part-time job, and I did a paper round, and I would spend my money on getting a Chinese takeaway. The local did this really nice soup, so I'd always have the soup, and I'd get a big prawn, a prawn cracker type thing with it, which was like vegetables and prawns stuffed in this rice roll thing, and it was amazing. Absolutely loved it. So it's been a comfort of mine for years. Every time I have a good day, or something amazing happens, I like to celebrate with a Chinese. And if I have a bad day, I commiserate with a Chinese. So I've kind of trapped myself in this reward, and comfort cycle with Chinese food, which has never left me.
That's amazing. When you come here to Sweden, we will love to like invite you for a good Chinese food in Jönköping here in Sweden. You said you had an undiagnosed ADHD. Because I had a course last week, and I've actually no one ever told me this before, but this woman, she was at the dinner, and he said, "Yeah, Jonathan, I'm quite 100% sure you have ADHD." And I'm like, "What? I've never even thought about it. I've never even considered it. What do you think? I have ADHD, Lewis, or what symptoms do you feel?"
So I haven't observed you long enough to know if I would think you were ADHD. But for me, it was, to be honest, it's Instagram and going through Instagram and learning these new things, because I follow a lot of informational mental health, physical health, all these types of accounts to learn whilst I'm just scrolling. And there's just lots of tick boxes for me. And I remember this one point, I was actually about to speak on stage and I was a little bit behind, which is also an ADHD trait, always kind of last minute with things. And I was getting dressed, ready to go and speak on stage. And I just paused for a moment. I just looked at myself, you know, those moments where you catch yourself being a bit strange. And so I looked at myself and I had my trousers halfway up my legs, one sock on with one shoe, my shirt half buttoned with my tie ready to go. And I was like, this isn't normal. This isn't how normal people get dressed. Like, I should be just doing one piece of clothing at a time, but I do all these different things at the same time because I get distracted whilst brushing my teeth and trying to apply aftershave as well. And I was like, okay, yeah, I'm definitely ticking some of the ADHD boxes here, just in terms of how I even get dressed in the mornings or ready for an event. So yeah, there's a few different tick boxes for me, but even down to characteristics of ADHD like caffeine. So if I have a coffee in the morning, it doesn't give me energy. It actually makes me feel quite sleepy. And that is something which is also associated with having ADHD. So there's all these things that are
You have
progressive.
many check marks
Yeah,
here.
exactly.
I'm not 100% convinced I have it, but I will definitely explore it after
Yeah.
hearing it last weekend.
Yeah.
I know gratitude is very important for you, Lewis, and so it is for me. How do you use gratitude and when?
Yeah. So in recent years, I think I've used gratitude differently to how I used to. And I'm a big believer, like you said, in being thankful, looking at what you do have, which is always a tension when you're someone who's quite goal driven. You want to grow, you want to succeed, you want to achieve things. It can always be a bit of a tension between being thankful for what you have now and what you are also working towards in the future. But I think in recent years, I still do my gratitudes, I would say my habitual gratitude. But I've also found that when over the past few years, and as a child, I didn't really get anxiety or anything like that. But as an adult, I started to develop it about 4 or 5 years ago, these real strong bouts of anxiety. And I have found that the best coping mechanism I have for that is intentional aggressive gratitude, which sounds like a weird statement, but if I feel that anxiety, I intentionally lean into it, but with gratitude, and I'll just start in often in my head loudly stating all the things I'm really grateful for, that I'm really thankful for, that even the thing that I'm struggling with, being thankful for what that's doing and producing in me, whether that's in my character or the lesson it's teaching me or the opportunity it's going to give me. I'm very intentional and aggressive with my gratitude in those moments rather than just my habitual daily gratitudes as well. So I think in recent years, I've kind of used it a bit differently to how I would have done when I was younger. And I found it really, really effective with helping move through that anxious episode, which is just a bit of an episode. It is going to naturally pass anyway. We know that that's kind of how it can flow, but it's really, really helped with that as well.
Cool. Yeah, I started doing it after. I guess you also been to Tony Robbins
Yeah.
courses. Yeah, and Tony Robbins was talking about the priming, and I've never heard about it before, but I started to dig into what is priming, and it turned out Tony Robbins did like 10, 15 minutes gratitude priming every single day. And that was enough for me. So I felt if Tony Robbins do 10, 15 minutes of gratitude every day, I will do 30 minutes.
Wow,
So I go back to memories of gratitude and I stay there and I walk around in like these bubbles of gratitude. And that has worked. I mean, I feel so much happier. I feel less worried. I feel so much better. It's like this amazing gift to give yourself every single day, and especially as an entrepreneur.
yeah. Completely. And I think particularly as an entrepreneur, because we are facing risk every day. Every day is a risk for us. And so if you can prime, if you can prepare, if you can create a mental playing field where you are in that gratitude bubble, and I love the way that you do it because it just so empowers the body with positive emotions. and you're living in that emotion, I think that's absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, you can wander around there. I have this memory when I play tennis with my brother when we are like maybe 10 years old, and I go into that memory, and I've done it now like hundreds of times, and it's so calm there. And in our hectic lives as entrepreneurs, it's good to have s bubbles you can step into and have more gratitude.
It's one of the things I'm working on this year, and every year I give myself a phrase for the year that I kind of work to and focus my behavior and intentions around. And in 2024, my phrase is dolce far niente, which you may have heard of. It's an Italian phrase which stands for, or means rather, the joy of doing nothing. And I really want to lean into the joy of doing nothing, because my natural tendency is to fill my time with everything or something, not always helpful, not always healthy. And actually, particularly on my trip in Thailand just now, having that in mind when I was sat there, like on a boat going somewhere, instead of being on my phone, checking Instagram, checking my emails, sending something, having a creative business thought or something like that, instead of that, just intentionally being there, being in the moment and enjoying doing nothing. I found it incredible the level of peace that that brought just straight away, because I'm not connecting into anything. I'm being a human being. And that's what I want to do more of. So it doesn't mean I'm not going to do anything all year. I'll still be very busy, but I will intentionally find moments to do the nothing thing and connect with nothing and enjoy nothing.
I love that. I will do that too then, because sometimes when I take my walk here, I just pick up my phone and I think, who should I call today? And I love conversations. That's why I do podcasting, but I love to talk business, and that's my first reaction when I'm alone. Maybe this is my first
Maybe it is,
checkbox
yeah. That's it. Well,
for
there we go. We'll see it. We'll play
ADHD.
ADHD
We will
bingo.
see where this conversation leads.
But I'm the same. Like, I love going for a walk, but if I go for a walk, I'll be thinking, who can I call on this walk? Who can I connect with on this walk? Rather than actually, it's really healthy to be disconnected sometimes and stay disconnected sometimes. And I want to do more disconnecting, so when I am connecting, I can connect on a deeper level. And be more present and have the energy to give to those things. Because I think I've spent a lot of my time the past few years actually not having any energy. So I'm constantly running on empty. And I don't want to do that. I feel like I'm actually robbing my partner, myself, my family, my students, and my community of the fullness of me, because I'm constantly giving of me. So I need to hold some of that back, rebuild the reserves, and then go again.
Why did anxiety came to you in the first place? The worry and all these things that led to you have to do gratitude today, but what happened in the first place for you to get in that place?
So I think it was already all there. I was just so fantastic at hiding it from myself that I didn't even realize it was there. So it was when I was about 26. I'm 34 now. I know I don't look it. Thank you very much. I was 26. I had my first adult relationship and it didn't go very well. It lasted about a year and then we broke up, and it was a very unhealthy relationship, shall we say. So that unhealthy relationship ended up kind of destroying all of the coping mechanisms that I'd been using my whole life without realizing it, because they no longer could handle the pain that I was experiencing, emotional pain. So they kind of just all disintegrated. And because all my coping mechanisms disintegrated, I therefore suddenly could feel all these emotions that I'd never felt before, one of which was anxiety. So I then had to relearn new coping techniques to handle those emotions. It was like being a teenager again after first love. And I don't know if you remember losing your first love, if you ever broke up with your first love, and it's not a fun experience. It takes a while to handle. But I was doing all of that as an adult, still running a business, still trying to do all these things and achieve things whilst handling the loss of first love in a very unhealthy way. So there was just a lot going on, which is when I first started feeling anxiety.
I'm sorry to hear about that, and I definitely remember the first like love, and it was not me who broke up. It was I was left there, and you know, you're like 15 years old, but the world like ends for
The
you.
world does end. Yeah, that is how it feels. Yeah.
So if we go back to your childhood, I was listening to some of the podcasts that you've been to recently during the last couple of years, and I heard you were actually having a quite tough childhood, and that you also was sexual abused as a child. What happened there, Louis? Is that something you even want to talk about, or how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about it. It is definitely not my favorite topic to talk about of everything, but yeah, it was something which, again, I wasn't really aware of, to be honest, growing up. One of the things that our brains are amazing at doing is hiding and covering up pain. They're amazing at that. And one of the things that happens when our brain is working really hard to hide up and cover pain is it does what's called dissociation. So my brain dissociated, held all these painful memories in a different part of my brain that it didn't give me access to until I became an adult. And it was only when I was training myself to be a counselor, as like a therapist, when I was around 18, 19 years old, that I went through this process of, because part of the training to become a therapist is you go through therapy yourself. And I remember one day filling out this questionnaire, which is what we would do with clients of ours. And we got to the end of the exercise of filling it in for ourselves, and they were going through what the answers mean. If the client answers in this way, this is what it suggests. If they answer this way, this is what it suggests. And again, just like ADHD, tick box criteria. I had all these tick boxes against childhood abuse. So I was like, oh, this is very strange. I didn't realize that was something that might have happened to me. And then it started to kind of unravel from there. And then these memories started to come out of different events that had happened and different occurrences where that type of thing had happened. And so then I started the process of healing from those as well. So yeah, it was a very interesting time, very, very interesting time.
I understand that. And you turn to church a
Yes.
lot, going into church, and you kind of you were talking a lot about black and white situations in a podcast I was listening to, and you kind of emerged in the church. Why?
Yeah, so part of what you crave, and you don't realize you crave it, but when you've had experiences like that in your childhood, whether you are consciously aware of them or subconsciously aware of them, is you are so desperate for safety and you're so desperate for certainty. And one of the things your brain craves, because all of our brains work on what's called a prediction loop. And if we can't predict what's going to happen next, we start to get anxious, we start to get nervous, and our brain doesn't like that. So we really like certainty. So what I did subconsciously was I lent very heavily into the church because it gave me a sense of certainty. It gave me black and white. It gave me rules. It gave me structure. It gave me morality. And it gave me a place to belong as well. So I had all these tick boxes that the church gave me as someone who'd experienced what I'd experienced, not knowingly, but it made me feel very, very safe. And it was amazing, an amazing place for me. I really, really grew up in the church. I really developed a lot of the good elements and attributes of who I am through the church. But then it also messed me up in other ways as well. So yeah, there's a brilliant quote by a guy called Sir Thomas Aquinas, and he describes the church in this quote, and it's a little bit controversial, but he says, "The church is a whore, but she's my mother." And I've always loved that phrase because if your mother is is a whore, you're going to be messed up, but it's still your mother. You still love them, and they've still probably taken care of you and done really good things and sacrificed for you and all of those kinds of things that a good mother would do as well. So it's never, funny enough, it's never as black and white as, oh, that was a horrible experience. That was really bad. It's not like that at all. Yes, there was some really messed up things for me personally through my experience in the church. But there was also some truly beautiful things, and I wouldn't change any of those things in a million years.
Did you develop certain skills in the church, like public speaking skills? I mean, today you're talking in front of thousands of people traveling all around the world. Did you like found some talent when it came to public speaking in church?
Yes, I think church really gave me an opportunity to explore and develop a lot of my gifts. I also love to sing, and church gave me the opportunity to really do that. And one of the things I miss most about being part of a big church is the opportunity to sing at the top of your lungs and no one's really paying attention. It's amazing. It's such a good feeling. So the ability to learn certain lessons, like speaking in front of people, and the skill set that goes with that, and the confidence that goes with that as well. I mean, they say that public speaking is one of the most scary thoughts and possibilities for a lot of people, close to the fear of death, which I've never really understood because I've always loved it. I always loved being in front of people and engaging with people. And I remember being in church and spending time crafting what I was going to say for a particular talk I was going to do. And I've always found it so fascinating and a real honor that if you are given a stage to speak in front of people, whether that's 5 people or 5,000 people, you have been given an opportunity to change and shape the way that people think about whatever that topic might be. And that I find truly fascinating. Like, how can one person at the front of the room change the minds of other people that they're talking to? But they can, and they do, and I find that incredibly fascinating. And there's a lot of power that comes with that, and there's a lot of responsibility for me that comes with that. I mean, the Spider-Man quote, with great power comes great responsibility. And if you have that skill set, some people use it for good, some people don't use it for good. So I always lean on the side of good because I do care about people. And I've just always found it truly fascinating from those days back then in church where, and I would love looking at the way that when you say certain things and you get to your point where you've kind of been building to, you kind of change the way that someone thinks about a particular situation or a particular element of who they are or a particular element of in that day and time for me, theology and the way that God is and operates. And then nowadays it's all around finances and what's possible with trading and with their money. I just find it truly phenomenal that you can change the way someone thinks, but you do.
Wow, I can look in your entire like eyes how much you are passionate about this this subject. Do you have like a moment where in the very beginning you were standing there in front of maybe 100, maybe thousands of people in church, and you just felt like maybe this will be my work to be a public speaker? Or was that something that you might not even knew about that back then,
Yeah.
or how was that?
I don't think I ever knew. I never at that point thought my future would be that. I thought my future, to be honest, when I was in the church, was going to be that I was going to be a vicar. I was going to run a church. I was going to lead a church, lead a community. That's what I thought it was going to be. I didn't think I was going to become a public speaker. I got asked to speak a lot in the church in different parts of the world as well. Which was phenomenal and amazing, particularly for being so young. One of the things that the church is amazing at is really raising up young people. So that was pretty awesome. And I got a lot of opportunity as a result of that. So yeah, there definitely wasn't a master plan to become a speaker by any stretch of the imagination. I just absolutely loved it. And the core of me has always been change people's lives for the better. And that's why I think I love speaking, because I felt like I could there and then in a moment, I could improve someone's life by changing the way that they think about something. And that was really powerful to me.
Do you think some people are born to be good public speakers, or is public speaking something that anyone can master with the right skill set? What's your opinion of that?
I've thought about this a lot recently, and I think it's like anything. There's people who are naturally good at a certain thing, and there's people who can develop the skill set. And part of the reason why I've been thinking about it a lot recently is within my own company, Star Trading, when we've been growing, there's been members of the team who are really, really good at what they do. They are fantastic teachers. We've got a head mentor called Josh Jones, who's phenomenal. But could he, what's the word? Deliver an on-stage presentation in front of 100, 200 people in the same way that I can? The answer is probably no. And that's not necessarily lack of skill. It's because I am who I am. And when I'm on stage, I bring who I am to that stage and I love it. Now, there's certain skills and techniques around speaking which anybody can master. That is definitely a skill set. Speaking is definitely a skill set. But even if I knew every skill set there was in the planet when it comes to speaking, there's something that happens when you bring you to that equation as well. So I and the way I engage with the crowd, the jokes that I make because of my humor, the way I move across the stage, someone could probably mimic it, but it wouldn't be me. So I think anybody can learn to speak on stage, but only you are meant to be you on stage. And I think there's a real distinction to be had there, which is quite an exciting one. Because I've definitely seen a lot of public speakers who are terrible, absolutely terrible. But I caveat that with they're terrible for me because I don't find them entertaining. I don't find them interesting to observe and to listen. But somebody else may do. So that style works for a certain type of person. It just doesn't work for me.
How do you bring more of yourself on stage? Because many of my mentors, I mean, I ended up having like some of the best mentors in the world, but some mentor told me like, yeah, these are the 100 skills you need to use. Another one said, yeah, these are the 50 skills. So I ended up so confused, losing so much of Jonathan and being so much up in my head. So I definitely had to take one step back and more trying to find myself on stage. What's your greatest tip there to be more authentic and yourself on stage?
I think the number one way to be authentic on stage is to know what you're talking about, first of all. If you don't know what you're talking about, your brain is going to be trapped on thinking about what am I saying next? What's this about? What technique am I using? What way am I communicating this? What way am I engaging this? I haven't had loads of formal speaking training. And I could probably, to be honest, I could probably do with having some more speaker training. I think I would def it's definitely a skill set I could improve. But I also know I do a very, very good job on stage because my goal on stage is to connect with people. That's who I am. If you're not someone who likes to connect with people and then you stand on a stage and you try to connect with an audience, it's always going to feel a bit disjointed. Yes, there's techniques and skills and things you can do to connect with the audience, but they feel it. The audience aren't stupid. And if you believe in energy, even if you don't believe in energy, if you believe in emotion, which everyone has to believe in emotion, and you believe that humans are capable of picking up on and receiving and giving emotion, then you know that there's that interplay that happens between an audience and a speaker. And so if you don't naturally like leaning into that connection and you start doing it, they're going to feel that. They're going to feel that uncomfortableness. So number one is know your stuff so that you can deliver your stuff without having to be trapped in your head and think about it too much. Number two is, I think, be authentic yourself on stage. If you're not someone who likes to crack jokes, don't start trying to crack jokes. It doesn't, again, it doesn't really work. One of my favorite things to do is I'll pick a member of the audience and I'll flirt with them outrageously the whole way through. And I didn't realize I do this until someone pointed it out, but I always do it. I'll always pick on someone. But it's a nice back and forth with them that draws them in and makes everybody else feel comfortable. Yeah, I think that those are a couple of my top tips. I won't go into all of my top tips straight away, but yeah.
Yeah, feel free to share because I mean, this podcast, there are only speakers and coaches who listen to my podcast. So the advices and the tips you're giving here are very, very valuable for thousands of people. How important, I mean, many speakers, they go up and they give the information. But some speakers like you, I believe, I haven't seen you on stage, but I believe you love to entertain too. And when people look at you, Louis, they experience a show. Is it so?
Definitely is. Yeah, it definitely is. And again, I think that comes down to because I know my content. I know what I'm talking about. There's not a question I could be asked that is going to throw me at any point. So I can just have a lot of fun with it. And it helps that I've been talking about what I'm talking about now for 10 years, right? That helps. So within my presentation, I know exactly where it's going. And I also know on each slide exactly what point I want to get across. So one of the questions I often ask myself because of the nature of I like to entertain is how can I share this point in an interesting way? Now, that might be a story, it might not be a story, it might be something else. I try not to tell too many stories because I think some people's presentations are just story after story after story. And again, that doesn't work well with my personality type. I like getting to the point. So I like stories. They are a very, very useful tool, but I don't want my whole presentation to be a long story, which is really dragged out, which I sometimes see as well. But there's people who love that from a receiving perspective. I don't love that from a receiving perspective. So yes, I do like to put on a show. It's very hard for me to quantify that or to give structure for that because it's just who I am as soon as I get on stage. And I think partly it's because I probably shouldn't say this or admit this, but if I was to just deliver information, because I've been talking about what I've been talking about for 10 years, I would personally be so bored. Like so bored. And so I have to spice it up and make it interesting for me as much as for the audience. And guess what? If I'm having fun, they're having fun.
Drop the mic on that one. I mean, when I looked at Tony Robbins at Date with Destiny, it was an absolute show. And what he did, what he used a lot of live coaching. So he picked up a couple and he coached them, and it was so exciting to watch it. So that's what I'm doing now a lot. I like to live coach, not in personal development and stuff like that, but in building presentation, building hooks in a classroom. It's an adventure because I have no clue how to like succeed with it in 20 minutes, but it's fun. It's an adventure and it keeps me growing when I'm doing it. So for me, show, entertain, and information are very important puzzle pieces in a presentation.
They really are. They really are. I often will say to my team, look, what we want to do here is we do want to educate our audience, but we also want to entertain them because if they're entertained, their brain is actually way more receptive to learning. It's why children play, because they learn through play. And we need to remember that as adults, we also still learn through play. We can do that. That's what makes the learning process so enjoyable, is when you have an element of play to it. So that's why I like to play with the audience when I can. Some audiences are less responsive and less interactive, and that I find quite hard work, but some audiences are great.
Especially if the audience have some critical thinking. I mean, if we can entertain and have the people laugh, that will create endorphins in the audience. And if they have endorphins inside of them, they will have less critical thinking. So when we show the price of our courses and our next step, people will be more open to hear more about it. So it's also like sales psychology to have entertained the audience before we show them the funnel or the next step, or you can join us here.
Completely. Yeah. And I think one thing that I used to do really badly, and I think a lot of speakers do this, or anybody offering some form of training, some form of course, is when people would ask me, oh, well, how much is your training? I would kind of go, oh, I don't know. It depends on this, depends on that. And what you've done there is straight away you've actually lost trust because you haven't been able to be clear, you haven't been articulate, and you're looking like you're hiding something. And so we want to make sure that when people ask us questions like that, as an invitation to know more about what you do in your service, that you're still presenting with a really strong, trustworthy perception of yourself.
Daniel Wood told me, Lewis, that one unique thing with you is that you are a world-class speaker, but you also know how to sell. And if you combine these two elements, you can become world-class and you can do large companies. How important is it for you with the sales aspect of what you do?
It's incredibly important. So if we go back to what I said right at the start, my desire is to help make people's lives better. That is categorically what I'm about. And if I decide to ever stop this current business, I know exactly what I'll be doing the next day. It will be doing something to help other people. That's in my DNA. It's who I am. And so the way that I help people make their lives better now is through improving their finances, primarily through teaching them how to trade financial markets in less than 30 minutes a day. So it doesn't impact the rest of their life, but generates some 5% to 10% returns every single month, which is exceptional. Now, if I just tell people about that, then great, lovely. But telling people about it doesn't necessarily actually help people. So how do you then get to the point where you can help people, that you can help a large group of people? You have to do that through a business because the business needs to make money in order to survive, to pay people to deploy and develop these trainings, which are so life-changing. So, from a mindset perspective, I've come to love sales and see how important it is because I've now connected that sales process with the fact that it changes people's lives for the better. Because as I'm sure you've seen as well, people who invest the upper levels of what's possible to invest in themselves and in their education, in whatever area it is, the likelihood of them getting great results is far higher than people who haven't invested in themselves. I mean, I even learned this when I was in therapy, in terms of I was a therapist and doing coaching, sorry, doing counseling and doing therapy sessions. We would do a lot pro bono, we'd do a lot for free. And the people who had sessions for free, they ended up turning up late. They weren't that involved in the process. They'd spend the whole time talking rubbish rather than actually getting to the meat of the problem and dealing with what we needed to deal with in the session, versus those who paid for their sessions, turned up on time, they were engaged. They didn't want to just talk rubbish all the time. They were focused. And so I noticed that very, very early on in that sphere, in terms of counseling and therapy and helping people that way, that I've kind of taken that now over into what I do here as well. And it's crazy how much of a difference it really does make when people do invest in themselves. So I very much believe that the sales is so important, and that's why I don't shy away from it now. Whereas I think years and years ago, I shied away from it a lot.
And what was like the big changing moment in your life when it changed towards sales is something positive?
Yeah, I think it was having helped so many people for free learn how to trade, and people were not making any progress. And so then when I started charging for it and people started to get results, I was like, oh, okay. And what we used to charge versus what we charge now, again, very, very different, because the way that we do things is so much better. There's a whole team in place now, and we've just massively improved what we do. I mean, it's embarrassing sometimes to talk about how we used to do our mentorships. So we used to do our whole mentorship was 6 hours delivered in one day. One day. Who's learning anything of meaning in one day and actually being able to apply it? Nobody. So now even our initial mentorship lasts 8 weeks, so 2 whole months worth of mentorship. Whereas when we first started, it was just 6 hours on one Saturday, and that was it. That was your entire mentorship. And it's just embarrassing to think that's the way we used to do it. But we've always evolved and improved and adapted to better help people master this skill set. So yeah, there's been a few change moments for me.
Yeah, I can guess so. And I mean, we all do stuff in the very beginning as we look back to and feel like, oh, how did I think there? And but I know that you've been working with Robert Kiyosaki's organizations for a couple of years, and you were actually headhunted to their organization. How was that experience, Lewis?
It was incredible, truly incredible. Yeah. I mean, when I started trading myself 10 years ago, well, over 10 years ago now, I just wanted to get out of my retail job. I was working retail at the time on the shop floor originally, worked my way up into head office. And I just realized that it was going to be the same job for the rest of my life. And I was like, this does not interest me at all. So I just wanted to get out of the job and travel. So that's why I discovered trading. I read Rich Dad Poor Dad. I actually signed up for a property investment seminar and I turned up to the wrong event. And the event was about trading, not about property. So that's how I ended up doing what I do now. And I wasn't, again, I wasn't intentionally thinking like, oh, in the future, I want to be public speaking about trading. I want to run my own education company. I was just thinking, I want to master this for myself. And the second I mastered it for myself, I started wanting to pass that on to other people. So Rich Dad Education, Robert Kiyosaki's company, asked me to come and do a testimonial. So I did that testimonial. They realized I was good in front of people, and then it kind of evolved from there. And they asked me to do some teaching for them. So I started teaching for them, started then mentoring for them, and then I started mentoring for them internationally, and then I started speaking for them internationally as well. So it was this crazy snowball effect. But again, paying my dues, showing respect, showing willing. At one point, I paid my own flights to visit my speaking mentor in South Africa. And because of that, I got to share the stage with Robert Kiyosaki, obviously meet the man himself backstage and everything like that. But no one paid me to do that. That was me doing what I needed to do to pay my dues, to get around the right people and be in the right places at the right time. And so, yeah, it was an amazing experience, absolutely amazing experience,
I
and a
actually
really
got
great training ground.
goosebumps when you shared this story. I love stories. So I was like, ooh, you went to South Africa and went backstage. And my first question, who was your speaking coach in South Africa?
So he was actually he's from the UK, but he was speaking in South Africa. So I followed him over there. It's a guy called Alistair Crooks, amazing, amazing guy.
Wow.
Yeah, really, really good guy.
What was the number one thing he taught you?
Number one thing I think he taught me was, well, there's a few things he taught me a lot. But I would say if I had to say the number one, it's have a really strong opening, a really strong opening. And I think that for me at the time, so I was young and I looked even younger. So I probably looked about 22 years old when I was first started speaking. And that was in my head a barrier. So I was like, and that was coming across in my presentations. Like when I'd almost be apologetic that I was in front of a group of people talking to them about finances and about investing. And so he taught me to not do that, not to put yourself down, not to apologize for your existence, but stand in a position of strength and basically take ownership of the session really, really early on. And that was a brilliant, brilliant piece of advice that I still use today.
I love that one. To not like excuse yourself, like, sorry if I take up your time now. When a
Yeah.
speaker have communication like that, it's like you almost instantly you stop listen because you think this is not important because the speaker don't think this information is important. Do you usually do some sort of hook in the opening, like to hook the audience interest, or what do you usually do in an
I do,
opening?
yeah. So one of the hooks that I use is I talk about my favorite ever trading day, and I'll show an image of my favorite ever trading day in terms of my trading results, but I don't explain there and then why it's my favorite trading day. I hold that until later on in the presentation.
Ooh, that's a good hook. So, when you were at stage with Robert Kiyosaki and you met him backstage, what was your first word to Robert Kiyosaki? Was it like hi, or was it you're awesome, or what did you? What was your first words to him?
What was my first word, Tim? I think it was oh, because I was like surprised to see him, so I was just a bit shocked. And we kind of our first meeting was kind of going through a doorway, so it was kind of like this awkward moment. I was like, oh, hello, it's you. So it's a bit awkward. Yeah, it's really awkward.
I mean, sometimes when you like study a person and you learn from a person for many, many years, it's almost like, is this person really human? I mean, I read Rich Dad Poor Dad many years ago, and I almost read all of his books. And if I just were to meet Robert, it would be strange.
I think it was definitely a bit of almost like being starstruck. It was a bit of that for sure.
What was your biggest lesson from Robert Kiyosaki when you were working with him?
Biggest lesson. I think the biggest lesson comes down to trust again. It's so easy to lose trust, and it takes a long time to build trust. And so out of that, I think integrity is so important. And that's one thing that Robert's really, really big on is integrity. And that's one thing that I think I really, really learned through that time.
Trust and integrity. So, Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I think that book has been sold for like 40 million
Wow.
samples or something. Why do you think Robert had this massive success?
Oh, I've got some theories on this. First of all, I think people want to do better with their money. There is not a day that goes by that things don't get harder for people financially. So everybody is becoming more and more conscious and aware of the fact that the normal way of living financially doesn't really work anymore, the historically normal way. We need to do something different to what previous generations have done. And I think Robert was kind of at the birth point of that kind of happening. I think the book itself is a fantastic story. And it's such a great allegory of what happens if you make these particular decisions in life and what happens if you make a different set of decisions in life. It's brilliant, that first book as an introduction. I think Robert himself has a lot of appeal to people all over the world because of the way that he looks and because of the way that he sounds. So his automatic like and trust factor, physically and audibly, is so high across so many different regions all over the world, which is brilliant. So there's also that dynamic too. But I also think he's just a smart guy who's done a very good job of making quite complex things nice and simple for people as well. And anybody who has that skill set will do very well.
I can tell you have definitely analyzed that question for yourself. But you spent 2, 3 years with Robert, or?
It was a bit more than that. I think it was
All
probably
right.
about 4 years, yeah.
Wow. I mean, I know, like, if you spend so much time with an organization and you go on international gigs, it's exciting. It takes a lot to say, stop, I will do my own business now. How was that process for you?
I think there's a couple of things that led to that decision being made. One of which is, again, for 10 years I've been trading anyway. So, and I also invest in property because I made capital through trading and I then reinvested that in property. So, yes, I was being paid to travel around the world with Robert and things like that, and speak on his behalf. And I was paid to do that. And so I should be, my time is valuable. But I was also at a position where I didn't need to be paid to cover my bills and my expenses and all of that sort of stuff. So I had the luxury of not needing to rely on that as an income to go into my bank account to survive each month. So I had the potential to do something other, and give it a go. And if I failed, I failed. And if I didn't, I didn't. So I'm always the person who's looking to grow and evolve and develop, and I don't want a boring life. I want an adventurous life. So I just decided one day, and I remember I was actually in Durban in South Africa speaking at an event, and I just remember lying in bed just thinking about life and the universe and all those things that keep me awake at night. And I was just thinking the logical next step in my own evolution is my own company. That is the logical next step. And so I was very conscious of the fact I had a choice to not follow my own evolution and growth, and stay doing what I was doing, or take a leap and follow my own path and see what happens. And I originally planned to do it as a kind of a halfway house where I would create a lead magnet, which would create leads that would be passed over to Rich Dad Poor Dad's training, instead of my own. But it ended up being that people were just asking me to teach them, so I ended up having to teach them, and so then I had to step away from Rich Dad and fully commit to doing my own thing, which was very scary. And it was difficult because it wasn't just, okay, my own evolution, set my own company, step away from Rich Dad. You have to remember that there's years worth of relationships being built there as well. Again, people who started to feel like family, and especially because I'd walked away from the church, I'd replaced church family with my Robert Kiyosaki family, basically. And then I'm stepping away from that as well. And you inevitably will end up upsetting or annoying people through not actually having done anything wrong, but people take things in certain ways, they interpret things in certain ways. And so there was all of that that was going on and happening as well. And some mudslinging happened as well, which was just part of the process of these things I now know. And none of it I've taken personally at all. It was upsetting at the time, very, very upsetting, but it's part of the process. And again, that part of the process was a story that allowed me to connect with other people who'd been through similar things, which have now led to us doing business together, which has been incredibly fruitful and amazing. So, yeah, there's a lot that went into that decision, but I think ultimately the choice to do it was based upon the fact I could, because I was already taken care of financially from my own trading. And number two, I'm always pursuing my own evolution and growth, and I couldn't not for very long pursue that.
Now I can relate so much to that experience. I did 3 years with David Phillips, and he was like ranked top eight commuter in the world, and
Wow.
I was the operative manager for a year too, and it was like I was his right hand. And we were going to dominate in the world. And one day I just woke up and felt, huh? What am I doing? I'm a creator too. I would love to try to build my own company. And when that thought started to grow, it's hard to like close your eyes from it. So I went through the same process and I ended up quitting. But I'm so thankful for that decision, and I'm thankful for my 3 years with David. It was an amazing gift to my life. But here we are, Lewis,
Here we
young,
are, yeah.
free.
And we wouldn't be here if it wasn't for those years spent there, because you do learn lessons that you won't learn elsewhere. And again, one of the things I think which was a really powerful lesson for me in church was my mentors in the church were very much, you learn by observing and then you get your opportunity. Like there's so much you learn by following someone who's doing the thing you want to do that, and you can't replace that. And again, I think sometimes I get frustrated by younger generations of people who have this real strong sense of entitlement, and they may be incredibly gifted, incredibly talented, but they haven't paid their dues in any way. They haven't put in the hard graft. They haven't done the necessary things to learn certain lessons, and they are wondering why they're not being able to create success or maintain success, because getting it is one thing, maintaining it is another. And so there's a lot of lessons to be learned through being on the what's the word? Being behind the scenes for a little bit, supporting and following somebody else.
Yeah, I believe it's like I haven't done university or something, but I see my 3 years with David as my sort of like education. But what was the first step you took building your own company, start trading? What was your like first concrete step?
The first concrete step was writing an ebook. And that ebook took me 2 years to write. Yeah, took a long time. And the reason it
I
took
thought
so
you would
long,
say like 2 hours or
no,
something.
no. Part of the reason it took so long is A, I wanted it to be full of actual value. I really did want to put some really good stuff in there. And if you like stories, I've put some stories in there as well. So there's some good stuff in there. But I also wanted to write it in different parts of the world. So each chapter I wrote in a different part of the world. Whether that was in on the train to Disneyland Paris, I wrote a chapter there. If it was in Cape Town and on a wine estate, wherever it was I happened to be in the world, I wanted to write a chapter there, because for me, one of the core power things in trading is that you can be anywhere in the world and still be making money. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to get into it. So I wanted this ebook to kind of be a manifestation and an example of that reality for people, which is partly why it took so long to write.
That's amazing. Yeah. So how many chapters is it in the book? How many places?
I think there is about 20 chapters. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you wrote the book, and for 2 years you traded mostly yourself, and after that you started to sell the ebook, or what was the next
No,
step
so that
to
we give
building?
the book away as a gift. So if anybody listening to this wants to have access to that, I'll give them a link for that. But then what I did was I created a course. So I created a set of videos, online course, and that I actually launched before I finished it. So I had the first, it was a 12-week course. I launched the first 4 weeks before I'd finished the rest of it. And then I just had to get very busy creating the rest of the content, because people were getting to the end of the videos and asking for the next bit, and I hadn't made it. So I forced myself to have this time pressure, because I, again, being slightly ADHD, I struggle without a deadline. And so I forced myself to have a deadline by releasing it to people who were then asking me for the next step of the course. So we had the 12-week course, and then people were asking for more than just that, and for coaching and for training. So then we end up launching our mentorships, which I told you how bad they were to begin with, and now they are phenomenal. They really are amazing. And then we created a community around the course as well, which is still going today. And it's an amazing community. Wonderful, wonderful people, all so supportive of each other. Everybody wants to see each other do well. It's an incredible group of people. Really, really is an amazing group of people.
You say we, was it you and your you said a name like in the beginning of the episode, or who were we?
So we is just a habit now that I say. So technically back then it was just me. Yeah, so technically then it was just me.
All right.
And then we grew to being me and Josh Jones, which is the name I mentioned before. So he delivers a lot of our mentorships now. He's phenomenal. He's our head coach. And then we have Ben, who's looks after all our memberships and people looking to join our memberships and our mentorships. We've got Lindsay now, who is our ops manager. So she looks after a lot of the admin, saves my life from admin because I'm terrible at it. And then we have a social media team, and we have a Facebook ads and marketing team as well.
I mean, just building a team is we could probably talk an hour of that because it's so important. I find it very challenging to
So challenging.
build and communicate with a team. How do you pick teammates, Lewis?
So it depends on the role. It depends on how I pick them. I mean, I've been through probably wouldn't be a lie to say 6 to 7 sales team members we've gotten through in 12 months, because they just haven't been the right fit. So that those mistake of hires have taught me lessons. But also because we realize that certain methodologies for sales, which we were taught, don't actually fit our business model and they're not congruent, they don't seem right to us, they're not a good fit for us. So it's finding people who match values is really, really important. And people who can work the system that you have for them in line with those values, that's really, really important as well. And people who can get on board with your vision. So our vision and mission is to help 1 million families live with less financial stress and have more fun. So that's kind of like our big vision, our big mission. And the way that we're doing that is through teaching people how to trade financial markets. So they have to get excited and be passionate about that as well. And you can't fake that. You really can't fake that. So you can tell when you're interviewing people if they have that kind of in mind. When it comes to our sales team, they have to be competitive. It's just a non-negotiable. You have to have a competitive nature because you have to want to win. They have to be driven to go out there and to make things happen. That's really important to us. When it comes to our coaching teams, so we've got a head mentor, but we also have a few other coaches as well. They have to like people. That's a number one. They have to really like people. They have to be good at teaching, but they also have to be able to trade for themselves as well. So we would never bring anybody onto our coaching team who wasn't able to also trade financial markets themselves. That's really, really important.
If you were to go back in time and you will do this journey again with your team, would you have done anything differently?
Oh, really good question. I probably would have brought on team members earlier. I probably would have brought on my head mentor earlier. I probably would have brought on my ops person earlier as well. And I think I probably would have brought ops on before sales, but that's because of me. So I'm quite good at sales because I enjoy actually talking to people. So I'm not very salesy, but I'm good at sales, if that makes sense, because I just want to find the best option for people. And I know what the best option is for them in general is to do one of our mentorship programs, because if they want to get results, that's where they're going to get the results. So I think you have to look at you, what your skill set is, what you're bringing to the table, what you're best at bringing to the table, and outsource everything else as quickly as possible. So I brought on sales before I brought on ops, partly because sales was taking up a lot of my time, and I wanted to release that time to actually develop new trainings and better ways of training and getting out there and getting the message out there in terms of what we do.
Good answer. As a leader, are you a leader who wants to pick in every in sales in here, or can you actually take a step back, go to Thailand, just relax, and the business will roll without you, or how is that
Yeah,
situation?
so first of all, I think there's actually a distinction between a leader and a manager. And if I'm again, I'll be honest, I'm always honest. I think I'm a good leader. I don't think I'm a very good manager. I think management skills, I'm still developing and still learning. I'm trying to get better at that. But leading, I think I'm good at that. Again, because I care about my people. I really care about them. So I can tell if my team are a bit off, there's something going on. I'll ask the question, I'll find out what's going on because I care, and that's more of a leadership thing than a management thing. I'm definitely not a micromanager. I'm probably the opposite. I need to get into the detail more than I do. And when I did go to Thailand, I did pretty much step away, and the business can, I would say the business can function without me. At this stage, in general, the business can function without me for a shortish period of time. Is the business going to, at this stage, grow without me? Probably not. And so that's kind of where we're moving to as a company, as a business, is how can we get to the stage where Star Trading will grow, and be maintained without that involvement, from myself.
Yeah, I will like follow you from behind because I'm always curious how, because so few speakers and coaches has actually succeeded with that, building themselves out of the business and the business just keep on rolling. So, so we covered
It's
that.
very tricky because you are your business in a lot of ways, and one of the things I've done well is we have very much built a community, which is why our community will still flourish without me, in terms of they'll still do well, they'll still get results, but I don't know if they would grow, because that really is my job. And again, my job as the head of the company is to be that voice on stage at this point in time. And it's very, very hard to take a brand and take you out of that brand, in the early days, because you are the expert, you are the subject matter, you are the person who does this delivery. So I think it's very, very hard to do, but I think you can get to a point where you're doing the things you love, and everybody else is doing all the other bits that you don't love quite so much. And that gets really, really exciting, because I don't want to stop speaking. And I think that's partly why a lot of us don't manage to get to that level of growth in a business, is because we don't actually want to. Like, we like the idea of the fantasy of, oh, I never have to work in this business, makes me money. Of course, we all like the idea of that. But you also love being on stage. I love engaging with my students. I mean, we just launched our own podcast, which started just 2 weeks ago. So we're very, very fresh on that podcast. But I love being on my podcast, and I don't want to stop those things. So I'm not surprised we all struggle to get to that level of growth in the business, because we all want to be involved in the bits which we love, which is being in front of people.
Yeah, but that's a very good reflection on that. Like it's like something we maybe thinking that is the next step, but maybe it's just an illusion of something we think we want. Because I feel the same when I'm off work for too long, I feel a little off. I feel like something is missing. But like after our conversation today, I will go up there. I have the energy, like it gives a lot of meaning to sit here with you and tomorrow to be on stage, and it's fun. It's a
It
fun
is fun.
life. Yeah.
Exactly. Why would I want to give that up? What am I going to
Exactly.
do? Just sit at home? I
Exactly.
mean,
Just sit
it's
there.
the same. I get the question sometimes from people, and it's such a, I mean, I understand where the question comes from, but it's such a silly question, because people often say to me, well, Lewis, if you're such a good trader, why are you bothering to teach people? Just sit at home and enjoy your life. I was like, well, I'm literally trading for less than 30 minutes per day. I've done the sitting on beaches and traveling the world thing. I now want to give back and help other people. Like, if you actually got your dream of doing nothing every single day, you would get so bored and probably very depressed. So you need to do something. Like, again, we're wired as human beings to do something. It just means you can do less of what you don't want to do, more of what you do want to do, and you don't even have to spend loads of time doing even those things. But I will always be doing something. I know I will.
When you say like trading, I do, of course, some investing in properties and stocks and so, but when you say trading, it's like in Sweden especially, trading is like some we associate it with danger, with risk, and it's not many people can do it. And some people even think like people who teaches trading, it's like it's a scam thing. It can't be done 10, 20% per year. It's like impossible. What's your opinion of trading?
Yeah. But to be honest, my opinion of trading as an industry is terrible as well, because there is so many charlatans out there and people who are just trying to con and things like that. One thing we're very, very strict on is we are here to empower. So we are teaching you how to do this. We don't take your money to do it for you. We're not doing that. We're showing you how to do this for yourself. That's really, really important. We have students all over the world, including Sweden, who have those same perceptions. And I think a lot of the horror stories come from people who haven't been educated, who don't know what they're doing. Same with property investment, right? If you don't know what you're doing, it's very easy to end up losing money. So when we trade using our methodology called the Star Trading Method, which was featured in Bloomberg because it's so low risk and is so data driven, we are so protective with the way in which we trade that out of your entire account, the maximum you can lose on each trade that you would place would be 1%. So it's very, very low risk. And even with that low risk, you could still be making, like our students are doing, anywhere between 5% and 10% returns on your entire account on a monthly basis, not just an annual basis. So that is the skill set that we teach people, which is low risk and high reward, and only takes them 30 minutes a day once they know what they're doing.
And during these 30 minutes, you have like a mentor, or how does that work?
During your mentorship phase, so during your learning phase, then you would have a mentorship session every single week. And whenever you need questions answered, we're there to answer straight away as well. But during your 30 minutes when you know what you're doing, so kind of after your mentorship phase where you've learned the skill sets, during that 30 minutes, what you're doing is you're looking for particular market patterns. If you find that particular market pattern, then you'll raise orders. So you'll enter the market, and then you'll raise exit points as well. So that's when you've set your target, for example. So when you're going about your job, doing your daily life, spending time with the family, and the market's moving, ideally it's moving towards profit, and then it hits your target whilst you're doing whatever you want to do, and you'll get an email notification saying, "Hey, I know you're just having your lunch right now, but you've just made 2% on that trade, and your account's grown by 2%." So it's fairly automatic, which is why we don't have to spend a lot of time in front of our charts, and that's why we can do it in less than 30 minutes.
What kind of, like, we've been talking about checkpoints, what kind of like check boxes should you have before you enter a program like yours?
Number one, are you willing to learn? Are you teachable? There's no point joining us if you think you know all the answers. We can't teach you that. You don't need any prior experience whatsoever, so that's totally fine. I would say 95% of our students have never even looked at a financial market before. So they've got no experience whatsoever. There's about 5% who have had some experience, and they tend to be the ones who are harder work because they think they know it all, but they don't. Which is why they've come to us, and then we can actually teach them the correct way of doing it. Number three, you probably need to have at least £500, 500 euros, good to go into a trading account. In terms of your education, I mean, our education ranges from £20,000 all the way down to £20, so people can start at whatever level they want to start with us. We also have free master classes which we run for people, so if they are interested, they want to dip their toe in, find out a little bit more about how we do things and why we're so different compared to other people, then they can attend one of those as well. So we've got a full range of support for people depending on what they want. So yeah, I would say the number one thing really before you join us is, are you willing to learn? Do you want to learn? So those are the two major things, and then if you've got those two things, then we can work with you.
That's good, because here in Sweden, I'm not sure how it is in UK and so, but here in Sweden, not many coaches or speakers, they don't even invest. They like they make money and they spend money.
Yeah.
That's why I recommend like Rich Dad Poor Dad's book
Yeah.
with assets and so why do you think more speakers and coaches who can in period make a lot of money? Because some people, they get famous and they have many speeches for a year or two or maybe three, and then they spend their money and suddenly they are poor again. Why should people invest more and take care of their money?
So you may be on a very good amount of money, but you're still just on a treadmill as a speaker. You're just in the same way that you're on a treadmill in a job. You are just having to fund the next month, the next month, the next month. What investing does is it allows us to step off that treadmill whenever we want to. So if we have an additional income stream, we have capital invested, we have money coming in from investments, we don't have to continually be on the treadmill of life of making money, spending money, because all that happens when we spend it is we have to therefore make more, and we create this monster machine for ourselves that needs to be constantly fed each month. And that's becomes a very stressful way to live. And what happens when, like you said, in 3 years' time, when your particular topic maybe isn't quite as popular as it was, and all that work you've put in, where's it gone? And this is why I love investing, because I work hard now and I can keep that money working hard for a very, very long time, if not forever. And so for me, trading in this way is the best way I've ever found to make your money work harder for you, and generate you a return on your hard-earned money. Because what else is going to happen to your hard-earned money? It's just going to go away. It's going to be spent. If you're just putting it in the bank, you're losing money anyway to inflation. The value of it's going down. We have to do something if we want to be able to A, be financially secure long term, B, we want to establish financial peace right now, and C, we want to see our hard-earned money work hard for us.
Robert Kiyosaki would probably say you should invest in property, but you want us to do more of trading. Or what's your opinion there? Should we put our money in property or should we do more trading?
So I love this question. I love this question because I am a property investor as well. So,
Oh, I thought you actually weren't.
yeah, I own property too. And guess what? I hate property. It's such hard work. It's such a faff. So property is really, really great as a long-term investment. It is slower growth and it's harder growth. And the reason I say that is because when you're trading financial markets, the way that I trade, the only person you have to worry about is you and the market. That's all you have to worry about. When you invest in property, what you have to worry about is you. You have to worry about the estate agent, the letting agent, the tenant, the builder, the plumber, the electrician, the local council, the government, because they keep changing the rules and the regulations. There's all these things that also come into play with property. Property is another full-time business. It really is. And people say property is passive. I've not met a single property investor with a passive portfolio. I've never met one. I've not met one. So it can be, once you get property to a certain level, then it can be fairly passive. My portfolio is fairly passive. I still have to deal with my letting agent every now and then. I still have to deal with the fact that a tenant's moved out or damaged the property. I still have to deal with those things every now and then via my letting agent, because I've got a good team in place. But I've got multiple properties now. When I first had one or two or three properties, it wasn't quite so passive. There was a lot more for me to have to be involved with, because financially it doesn't make sense to pass those things over to somebody else. So this is why I recommend trading as being the starting point that people should go for, because it generates capital in a way that property doesn't. Once you spend that money on a property, you're then back to square one. Whereas with trading, you can generate, 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 generate.
So when I read Tony Robbins' book, Money Master the Game, he was more of like invest your money in index funds, like in global index funds. Would you prefer that, or what's your opinion on index funds?
So index funds, on average, the statistic which is always given is that you will grow your money on average 10% per year. Lovely. We can do that every single month with our trading. So do you want to make 10% in a year, or do you want to make 10% on a month? I know which one I go for. But also, that advice is lovely advice depending on where the market is and depending on your age. If you are an older person, investing in index trackers is a bad idea, particularly at the moment because we are due a market crash. How many years are you going to be able to benefit from that average of 10% per year? If you're a young person, then it's a bit different. Then go for it. Even though we're due a market crash, I would still be saying, yeah, ETF trackers. Build in that buffer, start buying now because in 5, 10, 15, 20 years' time, you will have seen growth on those ETFs. However, again, what do you want to do? And I'm not saying don't do that, but maybe that's what you do with part of your portfolio of capital that you've got willing to put somewhere else. But why not have another pot of capital which you actually actively trade, where you can see far greater and exceptional returns, and then take those profits and reinvest those profits into either property or into index trackers or other forms of stocks and shares as well? That's probably a better way around. So the blanket rule that he kind of gives isn't a bad rule, but it is a blanket rule that's missing nuance and context for individuals. So there's definitely some more things to think about in there.
Good answer, Lewis. So if some of my listeners, including myself, wants to learn more about trading, what would be the first step working with you, Lewis? That would be your online course, right? Or was it a
Yes.
mentorship? But on the online course is the first
The
or your
best
challenge,
place
maybe.
to start probably is on one of our free masterclasses. And I'll give you the link to that as well, so we can put it in the notes. That's probably the best place to start. When people register for the masterclass, we'll send them the ebook anyway, so they can read that ebook too ahead of the masterclass. But it's a 60 to 90 minute session, which will give you a really, really good overview of what we do and how we do it. It's kind of like a first date. So I don't want us to get married straight away. I don't know if I like you yet. I mean, I do like you, Jonathan. I think you're great. But let's get to know each other first. Let's make sure you are comfortable with the style of trading that we do. The way that we deliver our training as well is really important. So we just want to make sure that we are a good fit. That's really important to us. So probably the masterclass is the best place to start.
Well, and we will put the link here in the description of this episode. Lewis, what's the best book you ever read in your entire life?
Oh, best book. I actually wrote down a list of 12 books for some people the other day. I'm going to see if I can see it. Da, da, da. I'll pick one from that list. There we go. So Rich Dad Poor Dad is obviously on the list. da, da, da. Right, from this list. Okay, so I'm going to go for one a bit different. And this is personally for me. So, best book personally for me would be one called The Body Keeps the Score. Now, this is not going to be something which everybody is going to want to read at all. It really isn't. It's a book about trauma, and it's a book about how our bodies hold on to traumatic events and what that has as an impact on our personality, our psyche, and our physical bodies as well. So that was one of the most impactful books I've ever read for me. But it's not necessarily a book I'd recommend for everybody. But yeah, for me, that was probably one of the most impactful books I've ever read.
Wow, we'll put that in the description here as well. Well, I'm very happy with this interview, Lewis. Did you have a good time chatting with me?
Oh, I had a great time. Thank you very much, Jonathan. Yeah, it's been wonderful.
You have something else like you want to share to my listeners before we end this interview?
Yeah, I think because of who your listeners are, I think the best thing I could ever say to any of you is keep doing what you do for the love and for the passion of it, and bring yourself fully as best as you possibly can to every element of what you do. And if you can create an additional income stream away from your speaking, then guess what that's going to mean? It means you can purely speak and deliver what you want to deliver purely out of passion and love without the need for it to have to perform financially for you as well, and what a gift that would be to give to yourself. So yeah, that's one of the last things I'll say.
Good pitch, Lewis. Thank you so much for listening to the Million Podcast. Have a good day, evening, morning, whatever in the world you are right now. Thank you so much, Lewis, for joining in today.
Thank you for having me.